Hello and welcome to the Humanising Health and Care podcast brought to you by the Point of Care Foundation. In this episode, Jocelyn Cornwell, the founder and first chief executive of the Point of Care Foundation, talks to Sir Robert Francis about his experience chairing the Mid-Staffordshire inquiries and the growth of the foundation following the publication of his Francis report. Sir Robert also served as a trustee for the Point of Care Foundation for 9 years after we became an independent charity in 2013. Thank you for downloading, and we hope you enjoy.
Welcome, Sir Robert.
Hello.
We first met when you were running the Mid-Staffordshire Public Inquiry, and I wanted to thank you to begin with for your very early support for the Point of Care and your continuing support for it all the way through. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you, but it's been a pleasure.
And you've had a very long career now, just dedicated to justice and patient safety and patient experience. And I do remember at the time that your report was published that I and many other people were very impressed by the absolutely incredible number of hours that you put in to taking testimony from patients and families and staff and listening to what were very obviously painful stories, and that throughout you'd shown such respect for everybody involved and your capacity to bear all of that and be reasonable and sensible and humane, I think really struck lots of us. I just wanted to say how very impressed I have been by the way you you did that. But I thought we could begin by, I wanted to know what you were doing before the inquiry, because as a lawyer you could have worked in lots of other areas of the law, but you chose clinical negligence, am I right?
Or? Well, I suppose it probably chose me. I mean, everyone asks about lawyers, like everyone else, so what do you plan to do with your career? And I think quite often plans aren't plans, yes, stuff happens. I started off at the bar doing general common law work, which is some crimes and contract work, family law, anything really that might pay a bill. There wasn't, this is a long time ago now, obviously, there wasn't such a thing as medical law as such at the time. And in particular, there weren't very many cases where patients were suing for negligence because of medical accidents. And the basic reason for that was twofold, I think. One was everyone believed doctors were all-powerful and incapable of being contradicted. Yep. And secondly, you couldn't find an expert to advise you about negligence because no one would want to shock their professional colleagues.
So this was sort of in the 90s or earlier?
Sorry, I'm talking back in the 70s and 80s. Yeah. So, but how I got into medical work was that we did do a little bit of work in front of the General Medical Council's Professional Conduct Committee defending doctors who were in trouble. And frankly, I found that much more interesting than anything else I was doing for a number of reasons. One was it was intrinsically, they were interesting cases. And secondly, we were dealing with very interesting people, sometimes legal problems as well. And it so happened that obviously the solicitors who dealt with that sort of work in the end, when it came about that there were negligence claims, dealt with those, and I began to develop some of those. So that I started off really defending these doctors and so on. Patient side began to come to me. And one of the important things about being a lawyer, in my book, is that you do take cases from both sides in any particular area, because you get beholden to one side, you get a one-eyed view of their things, and you're not actually providing the best service to your client. So I ended up doing those sort of cases on both sides of things. And of course, in doing that, I met a lot of tragedy, but I also met a lot of fantastic people, both in terms of dedicated professionals who'd been just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and also the experts who were often people at the top of their profession. So I got quite an insight through that sort of work into what makes up all the ingredients of medical accidents, and indeed the safety implications of that. And I became increasingly frustrated, if the truth be known, that when I did cases where things had obviously gone wrong, how little learning seemed to be taken out of those cases.
Mm. And did you notice things change after 2000? Because from 2004, Organisation with a Memory was published, yeah. wasn't it? And early 2000s, medical profession accepted the research that showed that patients were unsafe in hospital, a certain proportion of them.
Mm.
And things, so for the very first time, as I remember it, people started to talk about the possibility that medicine could cause harm as well as good.
Yeah, I think that I did see changes, but actually not necessarily through the cases I did, but the problem was, and lasted for a long time, there's this defensive attitude.
Mm.
And one might say an insurance company-based attitude, which was, you know, we want to save money, frankly, rather than saving lives, if one could put it dramatically. They wouldn't have thought about it in that way. But it was very difficult to get cases settled because it was very difficult to get an acceptance that something had gone wrong. And I think I saw it more that the law began to change. There was the law judges had a huge respect, as all the rest of us have, for doctors, and notoriously were very reluctant to find doctors had been negligent. And indeed, the test of negligence in medical cases almost allowed the medical profession to write the standards for themselves. And that has slowly changed. And it's changed in part because of awful cases like Shipman and others, where perhaps it became judicially recognised we perhaps couldn't rely on doctors' judgment as much as we had perhaps in the past as lawyers. There was also the movement away from paternalism in terms of the doctor knows best towards the emphasis on patients having to consent to operations or treatment on the basis of an informed position. And that changed in the course of my career.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Because we take informed consent for granted now, but just knowing that it wasn't like that. So do you know why you were chosen to chair the inquiry in particular? Why you?
Here's one of the features of appointments of chairs of public inquiries, that there is no transparency whatsoever in the process. So literally I received a telephone call out of the blue from a civil servant who I happened to have met in another context, who asked me if I would be interested in doing an inquiry into a place called Stafford. I might not have heard of it, which I hadn't actually.
No.
I'd heard of Stafford, obviously, but not for this particular issue. And I had to make my mind up. This was the first inquiry, which was the independent inquiry. I was asked to make my mind up within an hour.
Did you know what you were taking on? Because a public inquiry is an enormous undertaking and a very long undertaking, isn't it?
I did. I mean, I'd been involved in public inquiries before as a representative of an interested party, or called participants, as we call them that.
Yeah.
So I knew what public inquiries entailed. I thought this one could be shorter than some others because of the first inquiry. We'd already established, and indeed the Healthcare Commission's report before it, we knew what had happened, and that's also what we were looking into. We were looking at the system. I probably wasn't fully appreciative of how complex that was going to be.
No.
But I realised it was quite a big project.
How many years did it take?
Well, actually, by the standards of public inquiries, not that long, actually. Mm. It took. I think it was...
On top, but that was on top of the independent inquiry, which had taken.
My involvement with Miss Staffordshire was five years overall.
Yeah.
And the first bit was two, perhaps a little bit under, and then the public inquiry. I spent a year writing the report, that much I can tell you. And there was a sort of 6 months, 9 months preparation into the collecting stuff and then hearing. But we did it quickly, and one of the reasons we were able to do it quickly was that we didn't do what some inquiries do, which is to collect absolutely all the written evidence and so on in advance and then have hearings. I'm afraid I thought this was urgent. So we just got on with it. And as stuff, I mean, we did things in sections, but as evidence came in, we sort of asked people to come and give evidence about it. And we sort of had a rolling programme, which mm-hmm. Meant a lot of hard work for mm-hmm. our team.
With distance from it now, yeah. What do you feel were the most important things that you found that needed to change? Because it was an absolutely thorough, comprehensive look at the system, wasn't it, as it was at the time?
Well, the reason I recommended the inquiry in the first place, the public inquiry, was that it was quite apparent to me that a huge amount had gone wrong in the hospital and with its leadership in the first place. The one thing that struck me was how everyone said to me they didn't know this was going on there. I'm talking about people in the wider system, the then regulators, politicians, local politicians. This was quite incomprehensible really to me. So it seemed to me that there was a clear systemic failure when there were all these bodies. No one to this day can give me an accurate number of how many bodies, the organisations there were who would have had some responsibility for things going on in this establishment. And yet no one put together the pieces. And there were any number of theoretical ways in which the awful things that were happening there should have been detected, but weren't. I had to try and put that all together. And a lot of people, you know, the further away you get from the hospital or the front line, the less exposure and actually people have, whether they be in government, in the Department of Health, the further away they are from real patients, real people who are around them, not as patients. I was astonished, you know, just a small example, to find that civil servants of the Department of Health, many of them would have had no exposure to what it was like working on the front line or even visiting hospitals. So I recommended they should start to do that. And actually, to a person, when I met them,
they
found that immensely valuable.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, how can you go around making policy about cancer or whatever else it is, unless you actually meet people who've got cancer and go to the places where they get treated? And the second thing, the second point was the there's a compulsion to bring forth good news to one's masters as opposed to concerning news.
Yeah.
And because if you're having to meet a target and you've got to meet a performance requirement, then that's what you want to tell people about. And you want to tell the public that too, quite understandably. But that led to two things. One was much more weight being given to positive information than negative information, and also to a misinterpretation of statistics in terms of their significance.
Yeah.
And finally, opposition to anything that contradicted that picture, and that took many forms, but the most virulent form of it, I'm sure we'll talk about it more, is the treatment of people who raised concerns and therefore the suppression of information both to patients personally but also to the system as a whole about things that were going wrong.
That thing about distance from where patients are actually looked after and where the work is being done is, as some would say, it's just inevitable. And that even if for a period of time after your report, civil servants from the department were going out and spending time. I don't think they're doing it now. And that structures above trusts and where care is delivered proliferate, don't they? I just wonder whether you were thinking at the time, how do we keep this constantly renewed, because it will inevitably regrow this sort of indifference or distance, you know, that comes with distance.
Well, I think you have to have structural solutions. I'm not a great one for commending reorganisations. I think they're dangerous in many, the time. So too much effort is put into looking at how the structure should be.
Yeah.
But it seems to be that you're right, and you need to have structures which require patients and the patient voice to be in the room, actually physically in the room. And there are various ways in which you do it. As chair of Health Watch, as you expect me to say, I would suggest that Health Watch or that sort of organisation needs to be represented on integrated care systems, for instance, but that's just one example. I think wherever things have been, how to treat people, patient pathways or whatever it is, are being discussed in general terms, you need to know what the patients think about it, and they should be there. You should talk to them about it. And this isn't just a one-off thing every now and then, a nice to have. You just need them there. And the one reason is because they actually know what it's like. But secondly, it reminds those providing the service all the time about why they're doing it.
One of the things that I continue to find incredibly difficult to deal with is the finding again and again and again in the investigations that are published and the inquiries that the fundamental thing is the failure to listen to patients.
Yeah.
Julia Cumberledge, in her report, she said the system as a whole, and she was going from GPs to the wider system, does not understand that patients are the reason, are their reason for being, is what she said. And I thought that was just a devastating indictment of the system if it doesn't understand that patients are its reason for being. And I continually ask myself, what could change that? You know, because it seems to be like the key to so much is if patients, when they spoke up, were taken seriously. But if I there's something about a natural attitude which assumes that they're right or that there's something here worth listening to, which seems to be missing.
Well, doesn't it start long before anything's gone wrong? It starts when
absolutely.
Patients first walk through the door. And a lot of things that go wrong are because, as you say, a patient hasn't been listened to in terms of what their history is, what their concerns are. And why is that in the pressurised environment that doctors, nurses are put in now? They don't want to listen because they've got time to listen to this stuff. Mm. So they want to know what the problem is. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they've got a problem, an algorithm kicks in and we go into a process. There's a pathway to put the patient on with a knee or whatever. Mm. As opposed to, well, actually, I've also got a vague pain in my stomach. Well, that's not what I'm dealing with.
Also, I'm very worried about my mum or something.
Or I'm worried about my mum or whatever else it is. And we have lost the, you know, holistic is a word I don't particularly like, but the holistic relationship between the healthcare giver and the recipient of that. And we, you know, the old-fashioned GP patient relationship used to have that. And the GP used to be a sort of gatekeeper who knew the patient, knew the family, knew the social circumstances. He was able to, through listening, and be able to make sure the patient went to the right place for treatment. And we've sort of lost that, it seems to me.
If it was there. I'm never entirely sure it was there.
It wasn't always there. Yeah. No, of course it wasn't always there. But that's, and maybe I'm being too idealistic about that, but we need to start listening to what the patient is telling us. But that also means time to explore what the patient, because, you know, I'm a bloke, aren't I? So I know that if I'm going to the doctor, the last thing I'm going to tell them is anything that might actually require me to need treatment. You know, the doctors always tell you, anyway, it's what the patient's saying as they're about to go out the door is usually the most
absolutely.
Important thing. But these days, there's no time for that.
Mm.
And of course, now into, quite rightly, you know, we're exploring remote medicine, remote consultations and so on. There's an even greater danger.
You did earlier on say that you knew there were examples where people were listened to well in services or in organisations. Mm-hmm. I wondered if there were particular examples that you had in mind, or if that was just a, you know, you knew it was possible.
Well, I do know the examples. examples of it. I mean, and I think the best I could say is, I think it's a bit of an example, but I think actually if you look at CQC reports about some of the outstanding places, whether it be care homes or hospitals, you might find examples in there of that. And if you went to the other extreme and you looked at those rated as inadequate, you'd probably find the opposite. But I think the very few, there's going to be exceptions to prove the rule, but you think you will find very few reports about outstanding hospitals that don't identify and describe a culture in which the staff feel free to raise concerns. To feel they are cared for. As well as the patients. I think that is one of the keys. But it is possible to do that. And we now, I think, know how that can be done. And so, I think the examples are there. And actually, what happens a lot, or should be happening, is that, you know, hospitals or trusts, rather, that feel they have an issue, the leaders should be talking to the leaders of these places. How do you do it? Because I don't think there's much magic about it. It is about leadership, it's about role modelling, and it's things like that, rather than what committee structure you have.
So what do you think has changed? That you can
For the best.
Name better. For the better, yeah. That perhaps wouldn't have changed without the inquiry and all the work around it.
Well, I do think that, although this is patchy, I do think that there is more transparency than there was. I mean, one of the reasons I think we tend to gloom is that we hear so much about things that have gone wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, we started with, the litany of the Keogh Trust, right through till today. There are all these disasters that still are coming out. I reckon, and I may be wrong about this, but I reckon that without the developments around with Staffordshire, a lot of that stuff would not have come to mind.
So the situation where people said we never knew about this, you think that is less likely?
Well, I think... we know it still happened, but I think that we are finding out about things going wrong in a lot of places much more quickly, and there's more of a quicker response to things going wrong than they used to be. Mm-hmm.
Let's just shift a bit. The year that your report was published, you joined the board of Point of Care Foundation, and you've served three terms, which is the longest time a trustee can serve. Why did you join? What was it about Point of Care? Was a tiny thing. What was it about the mission that attracted you?
Well, you know, partly what we've just been talking about, which was here as an organisation which not only identified, described the values that I've been talking about, it actually provided practical solutions as to what you did about it. And whether it be Schwartz rounds or other things. And there were so few examples, frankly, available to you of that thing. What was the practical thing you put in place?
Yeah.
I mean, I struggled, and I've come back to Pompeii now, but I struggled with, what do I recommend? Put this right. And because I ended up notoriously with 290 recommendations.
Oh, I thought it was 250.
No, you didn't get to the last page. Many people politely criticised me for that. Mm. But the thing was, they were a mixture of systemic change type recommendations, but also, I thought, just some practical things that mattered to patients, which still some of those don't happen much. Like having a named consultant, having the name above the bed, all those sort of level things are practical things that can, and most patients would tell you, do make a difference. When I came to getting back to the Point of Care Foundation, here was an idea which demonstrably worked in relation to improving the staff experience. Clearly, it was going to improve patient care. That's why I was very enthusiastic about the Foundation and felt it needed a boost, and I hope I help contribute to getting one.
Right, I think no question. Having you on the board and some of the other people when we were so small actually made people take it very seriously in a way that they might not have done otherwise.
But the advantage of it was it wasn't established. It wasn't.
No, it was unknown.
And actually, therefore, I think there's a greater freedom to develop something than if we've been a bit hidebound by haven't been around for too long.
Yeah, that was what excited me about it. Yeah. And
I think it would never have happened without you.
No. Well, I think the fact that we'd started at the King's Fund as well gave us great pedigree, didn't it?
Exactly.
Because King's Fund somehow conferred this is okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Once we got going, I was almost continuously amazed by how relatively easy it was to spread the short strands.
Mm.
That whenever you spoke about them, you would find people in the room saying, "I'd like to do that. Can you tell me more?" And, and then, whereas in the past, I'd been involved in trying to make change from different places, and it was always more difficult than that. But the work that we did and that Point of Care continues to do around directly on patients' experience rather than staff experience continues to be much, much harder, both to get into the system and actually just, it's more intellectually challenging. It's just much, much, much more difficult work, it seems to me, and harder to sustain as well than the rounds are.
Mm.
And I just wondered if you had reflections on that.
You're absolutely right. That certainly was my observation. Mm. I think it's something to do with the fact that the shorts round as a concept.
Mm.
It's one of those things, firstly, that when you explain what it is, it's a sort of light bulb moment. Well, of course that would be a good thing. But secondly, there was a ready-made package which we just provided.
Yeah.
And so it needed remarkably little effort and actually not a huge amount of resource for it, particularly at the beginning when the Department of Health were backing it and the word this was really helpful. And it was thought it was safe because it had sort of been accredited, if you like, perhaps partly by MyoKart, but also by the Schwartz Institute. You know, the whole thing had a structure to it.
And we could point to the fact it had been going in the States for some time.
And you could very swiftly point to examples where it was working here. So,
so
I think it was very easy for people who were looking at solutions, as it were, to this cultural challenge to say, well, this is something we can do.
Yeah.
Maybe there was a bit of a risk that they would think this is the solution to everything, and of course it's not. And it's not the only way, of course, in which you can necessarily do this particular piece of care of the staff.
So we're sort of coming to the end.
Oh.
So sad. after the report was published, the Mid-Staffordshire reports, plural, you've taken on, or since then, you've taken on a lot of different roles in public life. You were trustee of Point of Care, president of the Patients Association, chair of Health Watch, you're a non-exec on CQC board. I expect other things that I don't know about. Which suggests to me, do you think that there's not one lever, there's multiple levers that need to be pulled to make change happen. But how would you say that?
Because
when you think about it, almost every report you read talks about regulation, leadership, improvement, education, patient voice, etc.
Yeah.
Do you think that you have to have all of those things lined up? What do you think about that?
Well, the reason for there being 290 recommendations, but it's complicated.
Yeah,
and you need to line all these. As we now look, we're now in the middle of, we've certainly realised there's a workforce crisis. Why is it?
I know. How long has it taken to
Why is that? Because, we haven't had a strategy of workforce. Each Royal College has had its own little contribution to make about their own part of it. No one's put it all this together. No one knows to this day what numbers of nurses you need in order to be safe and particular place. So you need a workforce strategy. You need to train people appropriately. You need to provide them with the tools to do those jobs. You need patients involved and in order to work out what they need. And you need a system that sort of keeps all this going. So yes, you do need all that. And I, you're right. I mean, I felt I wanted to help the Care Foundation because it seemed to be staff well-being was a really important bit of this.
And nobody was really talking about it.
Now, and I think, to be fair, they are now, which is probably another thing, which is not better. Although the implementation of that is really patchy because you know. It's thought to be one of those soft areas which can be cut in times of austerity, as opposed to the very opposite should be.
Absolutely, fundamental.
More resources into that. And obviously the Patients Association and Health Watch is important because, very important, probably the most important thing because of what the patients can tell you. And as regulation, I would actually say, comes, I mean, people always accuse me actually, writing a report was all about regulation. It wasn't. Regulation it will never be the answer on its own. All it does is it provides you with a means and any one means of detecting whether things are going wrong or have gone wrong. But almost by definition, the regulator arrives on the scene too late. But can help set standards. And I think also, as I would like to think, CQC has done well. I've been on its board, has been increasingly sought to be supportive. A supportive regulator in the sense that we are here to make sure standards are kept, but actually we're also here to describe the situation. So I think our state of care reports have been very powerful in actually explaining the systemic issues that are often leading to poor care.
We've come to the end of my questions.
We're fine.
Is there anything else that you'd like to say? I mean, does it seem...
There are lots of things I could say. It's been an amazing and privileged, actually, period of time. I obviously, if you'd asked me 20 years ago, would I have had the experience I've had in the last 10 years? And the answer was no. But it's been a privileged position. And I think not enough people have a position of being able to have a sort of oversight of the system and its complexities and its darkest corners and its bright parts. And I think actually maybe that's, I can't solve these things, but we need more people who have that sort of slightly independent view, but know enough about it all, as opposed to the NHS is a lot of villages and towns and countries, professional ones.
A lot
of the time they unwittingly work against each other. And actually, if they sort of sit more globally and look at and the sort of national multidisciplinary team profile, I might almost say, we probably get further more quickly.
Interesting.
Just a thought.
Thank you.
Pleasure. It was nice to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Humanising Health and Care podcast. You can find all episodes and more on our website at pointofcarefoundation.org.uk, and be sure to subscribe wherever you listen and follow us on Twitter to be notified when our next episode is available. Thank you.